Good morning, and welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. My name is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science, both here in the Triangle area and elsewhere. We focus on one particular scientific topic of interest, talk to an expert or experts on the subject, and give you the opportunity to call in with your questions or comments. If you would like to join the conversation, you can feel free to give us a call at 919-929-9601. And, of course, you're welcome to make comments at any time via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the show, which you can find at home.earthlink.net/radioinvivo. And on the website, you can access all of our past programs, or on the station's website, which of course is communityradio.coop. And it's getting to be quite an extensive archive on a wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show. So I hope you'll take the time to check it out. And before we press on, I want to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvarok. Claudio is a master storyteller and a performing poet and author. He is available for bookings, so please check out his website at www.claudioarts.com. He performed recently at the Century Center here in Carrboro, and one of his poems is featured in the most recent issue of the West End Poetry Newsletter. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to visit with Dr. Ann Yoder, who since January 2006 has been the director of the Duke Lemur Center. The Lemur Center was established in 1966 and is today the world's largest sanctuary for rare and endangered prosimian primates, with more than 50 species in residence. In other words, they live there. Ann received her BA in zoology from right here in UNC Chapel Hill and has been on the faculty of Northwestern University Medical School and Yale University. She came back to Duke in mid-2005 to join the faculty as a professor with a dual appointment in the departments of biology and biological anthropology and anatomy. Ann, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you, Ernie. It's great to be here.
I understand, Ann, that assuming the helm at the Lemur Center has really brought your career full circle in a way. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, I can, but first I want to make a slight correction to your introduction.
Oh, please do.
Although there are over 50 species of lemurs alive in the world and living in Madagascar, we only have about 24 of the species, and several of those are actually lorises from Asia and Africa. So I don't want everyone to be thinking that we have every species of lemur at the Lemur Center. I wish we did, but we don't.
I see. Well, I'm sure you're working on it.
Yeah. So the full circle. You want to hear about the full circle?
Yes.
Well, it all began actually as an undergraduate here in Chapel Hill at UNC. And I was a zoology major, as you mentioned, and but had many, many diverse interests, including art and technical theater and literature, and was a bit all over the map. And I happened to take a course in primate behavior from Dr. Laura Vick, and she took us on a tour of the Lemur Center, then called the Duke Primate Center, and it kind of blew my mind seeing all those animals. They're just a spectacular array. And from that moment on, it just focused my entire scientific career. And I went to the Smithsonian from there and was a technician and learned a great deal about systematic biology and biogeography and evolutionary biology. And everything I learned, it all fed back into the diversity of lemurs that I had seen and helped me to understand how that diversity might have come to be. And I became more and more interested in that diversity, and you know, it just kept feeding and feeding. And then I went to Duke for graduate school, inspired by these interests, and the rest is history.
Well, that's such a wonderful story. I'm sure that you know, with as many tour groups as you have come through and school field trips, that it's probably not the only life-changing experience that's happened as a result, but you are certainly a case in point.
Yes, indeed. Well, in fact, that's one reason that we're so dedicated to our public service and public outreach missions, is that we want to have school kids all the way from kindergarten up through college and graduate school have that same experience of wow, and just go with fresh eyes and look at the world and curiosity about how diversity came to be, biodiversity. I mean, that's a big topic in the world, is, you know, the environmental crisis, and your predecessors here on the radio certainly talking about global warming and the threat
right.
to...
And we will not be singing Oklahoma.
No, that's right. We'll pick some Malagasy song.
There you go. Ann, I read that a few years back there was talk at Duke about possibly closing what was then the Duke University Primate Center, that the research wasn't cutting edge enough, that the educational mission had kind of lost its way, and that it was really going to take a large commitment of money and resources to turn it around, which, of course, is exactly what happened. And now the Lemur Center has come back strong with a new name and a new mission, and, of course, a dynamic new director. So can you kind of give us the background about all that, how the center was saved and where things stand today?
Well, the center has always been of great value, but it just had drifted away from the university's mission. So we have a tripartite mission that we talk about, and that's conservation, education, and research. And my mission, as I see it as director, is to bring equilibrium back to those three missions. I think the conservation mission, which of course is absolutely fundamental to what we do, had taken precedence over all the other missions, but it's really not Duke's Duke's responsibility to conserve lemurs in the world. It's a private university, and students are paying a great deal of money to go there for an education. So I think what the university wanted to see was a demonstration that the research and education missions of the center were feeding a role for the university.
And a little more closely integrated.
Yeah, definitely. And an interim director was hired, Dr. William Highlander, who came in and rolled up his sleeves and really literally banged on doors around Duke's campus, asking people what sorts of research interests they had and how it might fit into prosimian biology and research, and he scared up quite a number of people, including Dr. Liz Brannon, who you've had on your show,
right?
And got those people in, and it was a incremental process, but over the course of 3 years, it escalated so quickly, with really only one single person going out and knocking on doors, that I think it demonstrated very clearly to the university that with committed resources and new blood, as it is,
uh-huh,
would serve what they wanted to see happen.
So the center was really revitalized, and
well, it's on its
now
way.
Now it's thriving.
We have a long way to go. It's unfortunately, because it had drifted away from the university, sort of figuratively, it's been out in the woods all along. So it's not on the central campus,
but on Irwin Road, right?
That's right, off of Irwin Road on Lemur Lane, as it's called. But the facilities are in dire need of upgrading, and the university has committed $8 million to upgrade the facilities, and we are now very busily engaged with an architectural firm, and we're in the programming phase, which means we are defining the scope of what we're going to do with that $8 million. And over the next 2 years, I think the place is going to be transformed as a consequence.
Well, that sounds wonderful, both for the center itself and for the animals.
Oh, yes. And I can tell you more about what our plans are if you'd like to hear that.
I would love to hear it.
Yeah. Well, so with this commitment from the university, we have defined the scope of the project, and this is sort of lingo, the Lemur Center lingo, is to get the animals out from under the plastic. And what that means is that for half of the year presently, the lemurs free range in Duke Forest. We've set it up so that there are large fences, and we cut down the trees for some distance from the fence so that the lemurs are contained within these large acreages of Duke Forest. And they are, you know, it's like, it's really fabulous. You can walk out in the woods and there they are frolicking in the trees above your head. Mm-hmm. But because of various temperature control standards that are mandated by the USDA, FDA, and our Duke IACOC, which is the Animal Care and Use Committee,
sure.
We can't have them free ranging during the cold season, of course.
Right.
So what we have to do is round them up. I mean, we have the lemur roundup that occurs sort of towards the end of September, early October, and we bring the lemurs in, and they're confined to much smaller quarters. We cover those quarters in plastic. We pump in hot air, and it keeps the lemurs, you know, alive and warm and, you know, fairly happy, but it's certainly not ideal. So that's our primary objective, is to build some new buildings out in the forest so that during the cold season, the lemurs can just be kind of rounded up and brought into their housing right there on site. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm. when it warms up, we open the doors and out they go in the woods. So that's the first objective. And then the second objective is to make it more user-friendly, to integrate research space and animal staff, animal care staff space, so that, you know, it just is an inviting atmosphere for both the staff at the center and researchers to come out and do their work and hang out and, you know, have the lemur experience.
Right. Well, that sounds just wonderful. I'm sure the lemurs will much appreciate the new quarters when they're ready.
They will all appreciate the new quarters, none more than the staff.
So what is the animal population at the center today? I understand that it's actually somewhat reduced from what it used to be.
It's drastically reduced. When I was a graduate student at Duke, and that was from 1986 to 1992, the maximum number of individuals got to up to about 800.
Wow.
Yeah, wow is right. And it was, I got to say, it was pretty fantastic. the place was lousy with lemurs. in those days, we let the animals self-regulate their temperature, and we just had heated areas for them to sort of come and go as they wished. And unfortunately, two had a sort of a bad outcome one winter, and those days were over. So, and thus we had to take on this new procedure of putting them under plastic or bringing them into warm quarters for half of the year. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that for 800 animals. It's just not, we don't have the staff or the facilities.
Sure.
So we're now down to about 240, give or take. We had some births this year, so I think we're up to around 245. And I think I'd like to see us stabilize at around 300.
I see. I was just about to ask you about husbandry efforts. I understand that there was actually a very significant success in that department recently.
You're speaking of Angelique, our II.
Exactly.
Yeah, she is a great success story and is a real testament to the dedication of the staff at the center. Our assistant director, Dean Gibson, and others had observed that we had successful II breedings in captivity, but it was always, in the second generation, it was always the captive-born females, but not the captive-born males that were producing offspring. So mm-hmm. the pattern was being set up so that only captive-born females were having babies and the captive-born males just weren't getting involved.
Right.
So Dean took it upon herself to really roll up her sleeves and investigate what the situation was and why this wasn't working. Well, it turns out, without getting into too many gory details, II reproductive behavior, it turns out, is extremely complex and has to be a learned behavior, particularly on the male's part. So it took 2 years of coaxing and coaching this captive-born male and letting him observe what the wild-caught males, you know, did to
uh-huh.
be successful. And finally, after 2 years, Merlin, who was the proud dad, who was a captive-born male, was successful in his courting efforts, and, you know, we had Angelique. So she was the first and only captive-born II that was born of captive-born parents, both male and female.
And that certainly is promising for the future.
Oh, absolutely. So we learned a lot in the process. I mean, there's a lot I could tell you, but, you know, given this is public radio, I should probably keep it to myself. But
were you showing him movies?
No, we let it, our dean took him in to observe a reproductive event, and also just had to encourage him because the female, when he didn't know the proper moves, you know, she would rebuff him and he would become discouraged, and Dean would coax him back with some, you know, walnuts and say, why don't you give it another try? But I was
Dean. Sounds so familiar.
I know, there's really a lot of parallels, I'm sure, with teenagers in particular. One of the funny stories is Paul Bonner of the Durham Morning Herald came out to do a story about this, and he's a delightful man and a wonderful journalist, rather understated man, and Dean was giving him all of the gory details of everything, and he was blushing increasingly, and he finally said, Dean, this is a family newspaper. But it was great. We were all so proud, and it's been wonderful. So we have hope for, you know, reproducing IIs in captivity, and certainly they are under grave threat in nature, not only from habitat destruction, as are all the lemurs, but the IIs in particular, because they're so very strange looking. They have elongated middle digits that are twice to three times as long as the other digits, very long and skinny, and they use these for foraging in trees to fish out grubs and so on, and it's a really elaborate behavior called tap foraging. But in any event, they have these big bat-looking ears and these strange-looking faces because of their strange dentition. So some Malagasy people, native people, are very afraid of them, and there's a mythology in local areas of Madagascar that if an II sees you, or you see an II and it points its finger at you, that you are doomed and you will die unless you kill the II.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's terrible. So, and the only way to save your soul, essentially, is to kill the II, behead it, and put its head on a stake in the village. So these, and they are the most gentle, charming animals that you could imagine, and here they are being killed for this silly reason. So habitat destruction and misunderstanding threaten them daily.
Well, we will certainly get into all that, and I certainly want to talk quite a bit about the research that's going on both at the center and in Madagascar. But perhaps we should define some of the terms for our listeners today. Mm-hmm. First of all, Anne, exactly what are lemurs, and why are they important beyond the fact that they're incredibly cute and endearing critters?
Well, that's a good start. Lemurs are primates, and just to give everyone a context of what a primate is, we are primates, humans are primates, monkeys are primates, apes are primates, lemurs are primates, larises, tarsiers. There are a few defining characteristics of what a primate is. It's a mammal, first of all. Typically have enlarged brains, have fingernails rather than claws, and there are certain other very subtle characteristics that define primates, but it's a radiation of mammals. Lemurs are one special branch within that family tree of primates, and to me, the great fascination of lemurs is that they are unique to Madagascar, one island in the whole planet. It's the world's fourth largest island, 1,000 miles long, 300 miles wide, so about the size of Texas, but it contains more than 15% of living primate diversity in this one island. So I did some back-of-the-envelope sort of calculations. So Madagascar's land mass is 0.4% of the Earth's land mass, and it has more than 15% of primate diversity. So there you have just this hotbed of living primate diversity.
Sure.
So that's one reason that they're unique to Madagascar. It's an evolutionary radiation, so we know that some ancestral lemur arrived in Madagascar some very long time ago, probably about 60 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And since that time, they've been doing their evolutionary Darwinian radiation thing and turning into all these marvelous forms. And for me, the fascination and what grabbed me on that first field trip from UNC is the diversity. It's just spectacular. We have everything from mouse lemurs, which are, you know, aptly named, they'll fit in the palm of your hand, little tiny nocturnal creatures, to the largest living lemur today is called the Indri, and it is about the size of, a little bigger than a beagle, I suppose. You know, if you can imagine a long-legged beagle in the trees. But at one time, and very recently, in fact, up to about 600, 700 years ago, there was another radiation of large-bodied giant lemurs, the biggest of which was about the size of a female gorilla. So this all from a single common ancestor, you know, everything from the size of a mouth all the way up to the size of a gorilla. So, you know, I could keep going.
You will be. Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that on Radio In Vivo this morning, our guest is Dr. Ann Yoder, director of the Duke Lemur Center. And we are learning all about lemurs and the center's work. And on your lab's website, you state that there is no better place than Madagascar for finding interesting questions in evolutionary biology. Why is Madagascar so biologically unique? You talked about the diversity a minute ago. You also state there that 95% of reptile species, 99% of amphibian species, and 100% of the non-human primate species are all unique on that island.
Yeah. Well, I mean, therein lies the question. I am spending my life's work trying to ask and answer those questions, and I don't think I'll ever answer them decisively. But it's a combination of isolation. So it's hard to get to Madagascar if you're a creature, especially if you're a creature that doesn't fly or swim. And so there's this isolation effect, so that there's an imbalance. Actually, I have a colleague at State University New York, Stony Brook, SUNY Stony Brook, who has described it as a pattern of imbalance and endemism. Imbalance meaning that you don't see any antelopes or, you know, elephants or giraffes or these creatures that you would see in Africa very nearby.
Sure.
You only see a very small representation of the mammalian diversity in particular that you see in Africa. Yet what you do have there is spectacularly diverse and unique, and radiate into these bizarre forms like the eye-eye. And in fact, the eye-eye is one of the stranger creatures on Madagascar, and it appears that they fill the woodpecker niche, which is there are no woodpeckers in Madagascar. So again, there's that imbalance issue. And so there you have a primate that's filling that woodpecker niche and digging out grubs from trees using these special adaptations.
Which in terms of the food chain is something that needs doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great resource, and why not use it? So, yes, and so it's every group that lives in Madagascar has examples like the eye-eye where you find unexpected adaptations to the environment. You know, you would just never expect a primate to do what the eye-eye does, and likewise birds and, you know, insects and you name it. And then the diversity and the imbalance, you know, why are some things there and others aren't? And so that's what I spend my time as a scientist trying to figure out.
I see. Well, I understand in terms of the diversity that it's very contemporary. That I saw an article that three new species of lemurs have recently been discovered. So is there still a lot of discovery work
that
to be done?
Well, that's what's, again, Madagascar is infamous, or, you know, infamous is the wrong word, but it's well known amongst evolutionary biologists as being a place of great fascination. And we know, it's seemingly, we know a lot about it because, it, you know, every time you go, you find these wonderful things, and so you hear a lot about it. So there's a default belief that we know everything about Madagascar. It is an island. You know, it's small relative to, say, the Amazon. So that's the default belief that we know everything there is to know about Madagascar. But in fact, we know very, very little. And another one of my colleagues, Steve Goodman, who was a recent MacArthur Genius Awardee, has spent his last 15 years or so conducting bioinventories. He does these rapid bioinventories, and he's going into places in Madagascar where no Westerners certainly have ever been. And they just go in and do these very rapid but efficient surveys of what is in these different parts of Madagascar.
Sure.
And every time they go, they find you know, tens and 20s, 30s, hundreds of new species. You know, certainly if you're looking at the insects, you always find an incredible number of new species. So it's right. Practically, you go to Madagascar, mm-hmm. you pick up a rock, you look under it, and you find some new species. So it's that kind of situation.
But even today, in the mammalian population, new species.
Oh, I know, right. And so you would think with primates, you would know everything.
Yeah.
And I'm sure what you're speaking of when you're talking about the new species are the mouse lemurs, probably. And this is some work that I've been involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And one reason that we're discovering new species in mouse lemurs and some of the other nocturnal lemurs is that, I mean, this is, again, a hypothesis or, you know, hypothetical explanation, but if you are a creature, a mammal that lives at night and you're looking for your mate, you're not really using visual cues because primates, like humans, tend to use their cones rather than their, I'm getting this backwards. Anyway, you're using your black and white vision to assess your environment, so coloration and, you know, different patterns of colors that some of the diurnal lemurs have are not so present in the nocturnal lemur. So for humans, you look at a mouse lemur, one mouse lemur looks like another. It's kind of brownish gray, you know, so same mm-hmm. species. But as we use genetic methods and if we're looking at vocalization cues, we find out that from the genetics that they are very diverse. So we're finding all these species using genetic methods, but then testing it with looking at their mate recognition calls, for example. So one mouse lemur that looks like another mouse lemur might be singing an entirely different song to attract his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the more we find out, they're using their environments differently. So it just takes a much more careful look at what the physical and genetic diversity is to identify the species than just walking around during the day and saying, oh, well, this one looks
looking
really different.
Them.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
this one looks really different than that one, so they're different species.
That's fascinating. But you talk about some of the threats to this biodiversity. How serious a situation is that, preserving that biodiversity in Madagascar? Are there major threats going on?
Oh, yeah. And it's been ongoing for quite a while. And it's this is something I always try to talk about when I speak to public audiences, is the complexity of the conservation equation in Madagascar, because in some places it's easy to identify a bad guy. You know, there's some industrial interest or a company that's, you know, wanting to, you know, cut down a forest so that they can farm cattle and, you know, sell them to teenagers, you know, sell hamburgers to teenagers.
Sure.
But in Madagascar, primarily, it's subsistence farming and rice agriculture. Mm-hmm. So it's deeply embedded in the culture that, you know, this is the way they live and they're feeding their kids. And so for a conservation biologist to march in and say, well, these lemurs are more important than your kids, you know, that's a tough sell.
Absolutely.
And particularly mm-hmm. once you've spent time with Malagasy people, they're very charming, gracious, generous people as a whole. And one just falls in love with the people. And immediately the concern becomes as much for the people as for the biodiversity. So it has to be a holistic equation that addresses both the biodiversity needs and the human needs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you ask, how serious is this? Well, it's very serious. And if you look at models that show what the present forest coverage is in Madagascar relative to what it was even 100 years ago, it's an enormous amount has been lost. Probably 75%
wow.
of the original forest mm-hmm. cover has been lost. Now, the hopeful note, however, and in my entire career thus far, which has now been a little over 20 years, this is the most hopeful I have felt about the environmental situation in Madagascar, and that's thanks to the new president, Marc Ravalomanana, who has promised very publicly to triple the landmass area of protected areas in Madagascar within the next 5 years.
Wow.
So that's a big deal.
That is huge.
It's what's called the Durban Vision, because he made this pronouncement in Durban.
Mm-hmm.
And so
are they starting to see it as an economic resource?
Yeah, well, ecotourism certainly is becoming increasingly important. But I think there's a real sense of pride of ownership that, you know, an understanding, and this is thanks again to the work of people like my colleague Steve Goodman and lots of others that, you know, I could go on and on, of educating the Malagasy to what their island holds, what their country holds. So the interesting thing right now is many of my colleagues are scrambling to identify. And again, it's not a simple matter to say, oh, this forest should be protected and this one not. So there's all kinds of biological data that are being applied and modeling and, you know, really sophisticated technology being brought to bear to identify those areas of Madagascar that will protect the most biodiversity and have the most sustainable future relative to human activities. So that's a big field right now. That's what's going on in Madagascar, I'd say, is the most exciting thing right now.
Well, that is very exciting, definitely. And it's good to hear that you have this this feeling of optimism at this point.
Well, it's cautious optimism.
Right,
we all have cautious optimism, but it is definitely optimistic.
Well, you know, I guess what we're really talking about here is what is really kind of an emerging field called conservation biology.
Right, exactly.
It's been very interesting to read up on that a little bit and see that it's really progressing as a relatively new scientific discipline, combining conservation efforts and research with more traditional biological research. In fact, I'm going to have one of your colleagues, and I guess one of the field's chief practitioners, Stuart Pym.
Oh, great!
On
yes.
the show in a couple of weeks.
You'll enjoy him.
Yeah, and it seems like that the Duke Lemur Center really is at this point the epitome of that type of pursuit.
Well, I hope you're right. Certainly we aim to be. And it's interesting that you point out, and this is very astute of you, to note that conservation biology as an actual scientific discipline is relatively new. I mean, certainly people have been concerned with conservation activities for decades now, as we realize that the forests were disappearing and the animals that the forests contain. But it has been more of a political exercise than an actual scientific exercise. And to define what is conservation biology has a lot of people thinking hard about, well, exactly what is conservation biology? What tools do we use? What hypotheses do we have? Is it science or is it, you know, is it politics or is it emotion? What is it? And I think that's what we're trying to do, is to bring the science into it so that the emotion and the politics, you know, certainly help to push it, but that behind those motivators is real hardcore, careful data analysis and, you know, hypotheses.
Well, and it seems like that's going to be very important in terms of long-range funding and, you know, certainly the trend these days for the large funders is to encourage multidisciplinary efforts.
Yes. Well, and sustainability is key. And I'll just muse for a bit about a meeting I recently convened with a woman named Claire Crimmin. She is a conservation biologist and probably one of the first that really is a very highly trained scientist who has taken her science in the direction of dedicated applied conservation. We had a what's called a catalysis workshop at NESCENT, and NESCENT is the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, which is now based over near Duke University, and it's a consortium of Duke University, UNC, and NC State. It's funded by the National Science Foundation, and what they do is they bring people in to have these think tanks.
Yeah, and I hope to have the director on this program.
Oh, Kathleen Smith.
Soon, yeah,
she was my graduate mentor. So
okay, well, I'll drop your name.
It's a small world. So in any event, we were funded to have this catalysis meeting, and our focus was biodiversity of Madagascar, you know, past, present, and future. And what we were doing is trying to decide how do we take the scientific data that we have about Madagascar's past, apply it to the present or try to understand the present, and then how do we project into the future and use that information to make sure that the areas that we do identify as targets for protection really are functioning ecosystems that mm-hmm. will persist. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because certainly there are many areas of Madagascar that are probably too, you know, it's just too late. And if you draw your fence, you know, your metaphorical fence around those areas and just step back, in 20 years, you're not going to have anything left. There are other areas that are still viable. And so that it was fascinating for me because I learned a lot during the course of that three-day workshop about the methods that people are applying to identify those areas where if you put your fence around that area, you're not only going to be protecting a large chunk of the biodiversity all the way from bacteria up to, you know, big trees, but you will have, you know, function and stability in another 20 years, 100 years, 200 years.
Are there other areas that are serving, that are perhaps further along that line, that are serving as models?
Well, there are two that come immediately to mind, and they're both in the eastern part of Madagascar. One is the Masoala Peninsula, which, again, Claire Crimmin was very fundamental in getting that established as a national park. One reason I think it does as well as it does is it's so darn difficult to work in there, and it's very inhospitable to humans.
Okay.
So it's easy to leave it alone. And then another area is called the Rana Mafana National Park, and that was something that Dr. Patricia Wright, who was on our external advisory committee at the Duke Lemur Center and was once upon a time on the faculty at Duke, she was instrumental in establishing that as a national park. And those are great models in both cases because they are doing what they're supposed to do in the sense of preserving biodiversity, but they're also very user-friendly for researchers. So there are research stations and, you know, there's very active science going on in both places, and we're learning more and more every day.
Well, in reading about all this, the amount of research that's going on involving the lemurs is just astonishing, and such a depth and breadth of research.
And we're just scratching the surface.
I'm sure. And, you know, much of it, of course, centers around evolutionary biology, as you've mentioned. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your research and some of your findings? And I'm especially interested in the ancient DNA.
Oh, the ancient DNA. Well, again, my fascination from the get-go has been in the lemurs. And from the lemurs, that took me to Madagascar, so that the umbrella has opened up to cover all of Madagascar. But my real passion is in understanding lemur biodiversity and history. Many of the things I've told you about lemurs are actually the consequence of my research from the time I was a graduate student up to the present. Mm-hmm. And one of the big questions that I've had is, you know, again, because Madagascar is so isolated, it's separated from Africa, which is the closest big landmass, by 300 miles of very, very deep ocean. Lemurs are not known as good swimmers. so the question, and we know that Madagascar has been separated from all other landmasses for at least 80 million years, you know, and there's some debate as to whether it's 80 or 90, mm-hmm.
but it's
certainly it's a long time.
Isolated
for a long time, and well before primates arose anywhere, really, or certainly contemporary with that. So unless you want to put all primates in Madagascar and then they disperse to the rest of the planet, which doesn't make much sense, you have to get primates to Madagascar.
And how do we do this?
So, well, that's we hypothesize. I have used genetic data, so DNA sequence comparisons and phylogenetic methods, which is sort of a fancy way of saying, you know, deriving a family tree. From those kinds of analyses and data, determined that there was just a single founder for the lemur. So they all come back to a single common ancestor that no other primates share. So the easy, you know, the simplest explanation, which is typically what we prefer in science, is that there was one colonization of Madagascar. I've also used these comparative DNA methods to hypothesize times of divergence. So when did these speciation events occur? And we use the fossil record. We use some very fancy statistical methods. And I have colleagues that help me do that, namely Zihang Yang, who is at University College London. He and I have collaborated quite a bit on these analyses. But we have concluded that lemurs are probably about 60 million years old. And so at that time, you then ask, what did the planet look like 60 million years ago? Well, Madagascar was sitting out in the Indian Ocean as it is now. Mm-hmm. So how do you get lemurs from somewhere else to Madagascar? You also use these methods to hypothesize the land mass, which produced the ancestor to the ancestor of lemurs, and that appears to be Africa. So you are left with, at this point, just hypothesizing that there was a freak event where lemurs, you know, a small population of lemurs rafted across the Mozambique Channel and landed on Madagascar. And, you know, again, the rest is history. They began their long journey to the diversity that they show now.
Something like as a result of a storm,
exactly. Well, that is the best.
They all grab a tree, next thing they know, they're...
And if, again, my colleague Dave Krause at Stony Brook has probably done the most geoclimatological modeling to look at what ocean currents look like, what the weather systems were like, you know, what all of these things that would factor into that. And certainly a contemporary pattern that we see now is that when cyclones come across the Indian Ocean, they tend to come from east to west, so they pass over Madagascar, hitting the eastern shore. Mm-hmm. Then they keep going to Africa. They hit that big thermal inertia of Africa and bounce off, and then circle back around, coming off of Africa, sweeping back over poor Madagascar. So they tend to get double whammies with these cyclones. So then moving from west to east. And today, you can look out in the Mozambique Channel after one of these big storms, and you see these enormous floating islands with standing trees and, you know, of course, you know, potentially animals.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So that's the most likely explanation. Certainly, we can't demonstrate it because it happened a very long time
right.
ago.
Well, certainly
but
sounds
it's,
like
it's
reasonable.
Plausible. It's plausible, mm-hmm. and there aren't any really better explanations. I've tested quite a few of them and rejected them one mm-hmm. by one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, one of the interesting questions to ask about Madagascar is, you know, how many failed experiments were there? There are probably hundreds of, you know, maybe giraffes got to Madagascar one time and they just didn't make it, or there was one lone giraffe. Those are some of the questions that I've been asking with my research. And now we're expanding the research into other animal groups. But now I'm now recalling that you want to hear about the ancient DNA.
Yeah.
The ancient DNA relates to these giant lemurs. So we call them the giant subfossil lemurs because we only know them as subfossils. What is a subfossil? A subfossil is an extinct organism that leaves bones, but they are not yet fossilized, meaning that they're not mineralized, and they typically are within the last couple of thousands of years old. So ancient DNA is a loose term to describe a methodology for taking subfossils or even, you know, partially fossilized bones or teeth, and using the polymerase chain reaction, which is how we amplify DNA in the lab, and it's mm-hmm. very, very sensitive. So if you work on just amplifying tiny, tiny little chunks, because DNA fragments very quickly after death, you can amplify DNA from these creatures that are thousands of years old. And many people who are listening probably have heard about the Neanderthal DNA analysis.
Sure.
And this is exactly the same methodology that's used to do those analyses. So we were fortunate enough in my lab to have samples from some of these giant lemurs, primarily teeth, and we have painstakingly used these methods to amplify DNA from the teeth of these thousands of year old lemurs, and have been then able to plug them into the family tree using the phylogenetic methods, and
sure.
discovered that they are part of that same family tree with the living lemurs. And interestingly,
so you were able able to establish the commonalities.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So they are part of the same. They derive from that same common ancestor that made it over there, you know, clinging to a tree or whatever we mm-hmm. want to, however we want to envision that. But one of the interesting things is that these, you know, animals, again, they were huge, and they, one looked like a giant sloth, and one looked like sort of a koala. I mean, they're very strange organisms. One of the interesting findings has been that the eye is actually sort of the basal lineage, meaning that the last common ancestor of all living lemurs was the one that was shared by the eye and the rest of the lemurs. So these giant lemurs were more closely related to the rest of the living lemurs than is the eye. So we're happy to have the eye still with us.
I'll bet. It almost sounds like the giant lemurs were kind of their versions of dinosaurs, if you will.
Well, yeah, I guess that? So. I think probably a better analogy would be there are the lemur analogy of a mammoth or some of the Pleistocene big mammals, mm-hmm. you know, that we had once in North America, that with the arrival of humans and, you know, various climatic pressures and changing climate and human pressures, you know, the big guys are the ones that take the hit first. So that's what happened with the giant lemurs.
I see. My guest this morning on Radio In Vivo is Dr. Ann Yoder, who is director of the Duke Lemur Center. Ann, you were talking a minute ago about the ancient DNA and the ability to amplify it and bring it into the family tree, as it were.
Yeah.
I understand that there is actually a large effort going on right now to characterize the lemur genome itself, the Duke Lemur Genome Initiative. Who is involved with that effort, and what is that going to tell us?
Oh, well, I can't wait to tell you what it's going to tell you.
All right.
Tell us. This is something that I have always been interested in. I thought this is, given the technology that we have now to amplify and study parts of the genome and this great diversity of lemurs that we have, and the I just want to state, I'm sure this would come out later, but one of our policies at the Lemur Center, we are very active in research, but it's non-invasive research.
Yes, so, I definitely wanted to bring that
yeah,
up.
Yeah, so our policy is do no harm to the animals, and of all of the exciting disciplines that's ongoing right now in the world of science generally is genome science. And all it takes is a little blood sample or a tiny little bit of skin, and you can know so much about the genome of an organism. So the lemurs can be frolicking in the trees, little knowing that there's all this exciting research going on.
Yeah.
Now, so this was something that I had brought with me when I came here, and one of the first people that I sort of met and engaged with at Duke that's in the sort of academic community there is Dr. Hunt Willard, who is the director of the Institute for Genome Science and Policy, or IGSP, mm-hmm. as we call it. And he and I had lunch one day, and it was just, we just got rolling talking about all the exciting genome science that could be done with this diversity of primates. And again, that's the emphasis, is that it's a very old group, and it's very basal, meaning that the ancestral lemur was probably not too distant from the ancestral anthropoid primate, which are monkeys, apes, and humans. So by getting at sort of the genetic characteristics or the genomic characteristics of that ancestral lemur, we're getting very close to understanding the ancestral primate genome. So it gives us a great framework for understanding human genome science.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Hunt and I just started jazzing about this, and pretty quickly we agreed that, this was a project that we should take on. I do want to make a distinction between whole genome sequencing, which is what's going on with the human genome and has pretty much been completed,
right.
and we're now in the phase of annotating, meaning, trying to understand where the genes are, what they're doing, what chromosomes they're located on, etc.
Right.
That sort of project versus a genome initiative, which is what we're doing, which is where we're going to go in and sort of shotgun approach and just pull out different parts of the genome and have a look at
selective areas of interest.
Yeah, selective areas of interest using polymerase chain reaction and other sort of more shotgun approaches where you just get sequence and then you try to figure out what it means. So that's more what we're doing at the Lemer Center. We're also hoping to characterize the some parts of the genome for every single individual that we have out there, which feeds into our needs as a center for understanding the relatedness and the inbreeding coefficients of the different lemur groups that we have, because again, that's a big problem with captive management, is you don't want to have cross-eyed lemurs. So we want to understand fully what the genetic relationships are among our lemurs.
So that will contribute to the ultimate health of the
to the colony. Absolutely. Yeah. And then to, you know, another application is we have just gotten a group of mouse lemurs from the Paris Zoo. We got 9 mouse lemurs from the Paris Zoo because we're trying to build up our mouse lemur colonies. But we don't even know what species they are. Because, again, you know, as I said, it really takes a genetic approach to start to understand. So that's one of the outcomes. Now, so those are the sort of extremes, you know, the human genome project on one end, where we're going to know everything about the sequence and where it is and what it does, to this sort of more shotgun approach with all of our different species and individuals. And then sort of in the middle, we're participating and collaborating with the Broad Institute, which is at MIT, and they are actually doing whole genome sequencing for the mouse lemur, for the bush baby, and probably eventually for the ring-tailed lemur. So they will get the whole genome sequence. They will not annotate it to the level that is ongoing with the Human Genome Project. So it's our job, really, to help them understand what the function and so on of these different parts of the genome are in the mouse lemur and the bush baby. So we have, you know, the full range.
Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of work to do.
That puts it mildly.
And shouldn't be taking time out to be on radio shows.
No, this is fun.
Well, Lana, before we run out of time, as I warned you, the hour goes by very quickly.
It does indeed.
I wanted to ask you about the fact that these prosimians are surprisingly complex in their social structures and behaviors. Could you tell us a little bit about the types of research that are going on in that area?
Well, I'd say most of that presently is, in fact, going on in Madagascar. So where there are investigators on the ground in Madagascar, in the woods, observing these groups. Now, we would love to see more of that go on at our center. And in fact, you know, 15, 20 years ago, there was more of that because we had a much larger population and we had all of the age classes represented. And so the groups of, you know, a particular species of lemur might have a social group that was absolutely natural in the sense that it was self-regulated, so that every time an opportunity for reproduction came up, they took it and babies were born and, you know, on it went. Mm-hmm. But because of our the need to reduce the colony size, we had to send a lot of the lemurs out to zoos and, you know, on sort of permanent loan, which is where most of the individuals went. But we also had to put a lot of the lemurs on contraception. Now, this feeds back into our plan, the scope for this new, these two new buildings and the $8 million and how we're going to use it. One of those buildings will be devoted to restoring large social group structures in at least 4 different species of lemurs, so that now investigators can come back, be, you know, in the comfort, you know, have the Holiday Inn down the road and be able to spend the day at the Lemur Center following the groups around, seeing how they behave, understanding their cultural systems or their behavioral systems on site at Duke. Now it's a little difficult, but another few years we'll be back.
That sounds pretty very exciting.
Yeah.
Now, what about the types of research that are being conducted here, such as Liz Brannon's work with the cognitive abilities?
Well, right now we have a lot of graduate students and undergraduates who are doing sort of behavioral observations, you know, and understanding, you know, locomotion and how lemurs spend their time, you know, what their time budget is. We also have Liz Brannon's research, and I'll just go ahead and speak about that a little bit because it is so very interesting. And if people missed her, they missed some really interesting science. What she does, she's a cognitive neurobiologist, I suppose, is how you would classify her. She's interested in development of cognitive function, and she studies everything from human infants to monkeys and now to lemurs. And the sort of what I find so exciting about her research is that prior to the work that she did at the Lemur Center, the sort of null hypothesis was that lemurs were pretty dumb. You know, that they were the dumb blondes of the primate family, and that monkeys were much smarter and much better able to problem solve and count. And
they're not
dumb,
they're just differently able.
Differently able, there we have it. But in fact, her work, which involves touch screens, so they're presented with a computer screen, and then they have various problems to solve. And one of the questions that she asks is, can they learn to count? And it turns out that lemurs can count pretty much as well as monkeys and even, you know, young human infants. So they're a lot smarter than we thought. Mm-hmm. And her research is, you know, really just taking off in that area. And she's, I think, gotten some funding to carry it on for a number of years and has quite a few students that are involved in the project. So we have a long way to go before we really know just how smart lemurs are. But that's been a fundamental shift in our understanding of primate cognition, is that lemurs are smart.
Absolutely. And smart and cute.
Smart and cute. There we have it.
And I wanted to ask you about, I did come across some what I consider to be very, very interesting, but almost fun facts about lemurs. Golden bamboo lemurs.
Right.
Subsist on a bamboo species with enough cyanide to kill a human.
Or an elephant, I've heard. Yes, bamboo lemurs are an interesting example of an evolutionary puzzle that's perfectly studied in this particular group. Mm-hmm. There are three species of bamboo lemurs. There's one called Haplemur griseus, which is the smallest of the three, and then there's the golden bamboo lemur and Haplemur simus, which I don't know if it has a common name. Simon's bamboo lemur, I suppose. Now, the interesting thing is you will find all three species living in the very same stand of bamboo. Now, that's hard to do from an evolutionary perspective, because how are they sharing these resources? Because you would think that the bigger, better-abled bamboo lemur would take, you know, sequester all the resources, and the other two species would just, you know, be wiped out. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, and this, again, is the work of Dr. Patricia Wright, it turns out that they focus their energies on different parts of the bamboo, and the golden bamboo lemur, as I recall, eats the mature shoots. So that's that really woody, hard part of the bamboo, and it contains tons of cyanide. And so they have some physiological capacity, some enzyme, I suppose, that can break down the cyanide, and they can digest it absolutely without any ill effect.
Sure.
You give that to that amount of bamboo stalks to an elephant, it would probably die.
Wow. Well, it sounds like there's just so much we can learn
From lemurs. Yeah, and we're just scratching the surface. It's hundreds of years of research ahead of us.
So your job is secure for a while.
I think so.
Well, Anne, it's been a really fascinating hour, as I knew it would be, and perhaps down the road we can come back and do it again, because I'm sure there's a lot we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
Why don't we close the hour by you telling our listeners how they can get more information about this remarkable facility you direct, the Duke Lemur Center, and perhaps how they can even arrange a tour and come and visit.
Oh, well, I would love to. Hopefully you all have computers and a web browser. All you have to do is go to Google and enter the words Duke Lemur Center, and it will pull up our web page. And on that web page, there's a link that's called Tours. You click on that link, and it will give you the phone number to call. It's $3 a person to come out and tour the Lemur Center. You do have to make reservations because we are, again, a husbandry, conservation, education, research center, and our public outreach is part of our mission and a very important part, but we have to monitor the number of visitors we have and sort of organize that. But that being said, you are very welcome and much requested to come out and see our lemurs and get a taste of all this magnificent diversity.
That sounds terrific. Well, Ann, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Radio In Vivo.
Well, thanks for having me, Ernie. It was great.
Terrific. Next week on the program, my guest is going to be yet another colleague of Ann's at Duke, Dr. Eric Jarvis from the Department of Neurobiology. He is a pretty remarkable young scientist. He was born and raised in Harlem, studied ballet at the High School of the Performing Arts in New York City, and wanted to be a world-class dancer, and still keeps up with his dance skills and, I believe, teaches some classes. But today, Dr. Jarvis is a world-class scientist studying the neurobiology of vocal communication. He uses songbirds as a model for understanding this phenomenon, and in 2005, he won the very prestigious NIH Pioneer Award, which provides $2.5 million in research funding over the next 5 years. So that should be another fascinating hour, and I hope you'll make it a point to tune in. We thank you for listening. My name's Ernie Hood. Join me again next week and every week on Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill.